tonight on Arena. Tola McKay and Leo Moran on different ways up and down the N17, and Anthony Gormley on why sculpture is the king of the arts. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And a very happy new year to one and all. RTE One Television's New Year's Eve countdown show featured a host of talent drawn from various areas of Irish society. But it was a new arrangement of a 30-year-old song that captured the imagination of everyone in a totally unexpected way. And I wish I was on the Yes, I wish I was on the N17, traveling with just my thoughts and dreams. Now, I'm sure many people around the country this evening listening to that song will have lumps in their throats yet again with that amazing version of N17. And joining me on the line this evening is the young woman who gave us that wonderful rendition of the song on New Year's Eve in that countdown concert, Tola McKay, and one of the writers of the original song, Leo Moran, who I believe, Leo, you haven't had a chance to speak to Tola since New Year's Eve, and you were very keen to do so. So off you go.
Absolutely, Tola. I would just like to say congratulations and thanks so much for putting your gifted heart and soul into singing that song. Thank you so much.
Oh, wow. Thank you. It's an honour, honestly. It's just such a brilliant song. I felt every single word I was singing.
And you know, the amazing thing is, Tola, I heard it as it went out and I watched it again today. And you do hear every single word that you say you felt as you sang it. You hear them in a very different way. When did you first come across the song? How did you know the song originally? And when did that new version, when was that presented to you?
Yeah, I mean, like, I've always kind of like heard the song kind of floated around, like from just, you know, growing up in Tullamore. But you know, it wasn't until I was given the song to kind of sit down and understand the lyrics and, you know, like with the whole orchestra arrangements as well, like it really helped me break down the lyrics and kind of resonate it and kind of see it in my point of view. So, like, yeah, the lyrics were just like amazing. I was blown away. I really was just blown away. I remember I had a moment where I was just like, wow, like it just pieced every like emotion that I was feeling of like, you know, missing my entire family. So
well, I want to have a little listen to for Leo's sake as much as anybody else's, because we all know the original, but you know, you can never hear it too often. Let's remind ourselves of that. I suppose a really great song can be sung in a million and one different ways, and it'll still be a great song. Leo, as you listen then to that, we were trying to get the words for describing the different emotions that come across. Now, yeah, there's a sadness certainly in what we just had. It's the young man leaving his hometown, but there's a little sense that perhaps he's not that bothered about getting out of the place, really, in the original version. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think the two writers probably had two slightly different takes on what the song might give. I wrote most of the lyrics, and I might be kind of being known to be a little bit more serious. Davy Carton wrote the music, and he brought that sense of devilment and joy to the song, I think, maybe. So it's kind of a sweet and sour mixture that probably works in different ways.
And it was Gavin Murphy, Tola, who did the arrangement of this. And that opening with the clarinets, you're just from the very moment that sad, lonely sound of the single clarinet plays, and then your voice coming in, there's just a depth of emotion into it. Where did you send yourself to, or where did you bring yourself to explore the type of feelings that you were getting through the lyrics?
Yeah, I mean, like, I suppose I'm missing half of my family. I haven't seen most of my family in, like, almost a year and a half, you know, because of the whole COVID. But then, like, I've moved so much, and I only recently went back to Tullamore. And, you know, literally, like, you know, with schools and public and primary school, you're taught in prefabs. And I also, like, lived in Galway for a while. So there was just everything that was said in it had a moment of truth for me. And, like, because it's the way I wanted people to resonate with it was for them to, you know, feel like, you know, to miss home and to feel like there's a longing to be back home. So putting all that pieces together and putting my own experiences and what I'm going through just allowed me to convey or relate that message quite well. And even with the clarinet and the whole arrangement of the song with the orchestra, it does have like that kind of like mournful sound. But even though it's so sad, there's a certain sense of like hope with it. It's stunning, really.
Yeah, I'm interested that Tolu picks up on that, Leo. I mean, I see that, for example, Dara O'Brien tweeted, "Well, this is just very beautiful. Well done to all involved. Very much one for the Irish and Irish abroad, this one. Maybe feeling, this is Graham Norton, maybe feeling fragile on New Year's Day, but this has reduced me to a sobbing mess. Huge congratulations to everyone involved in putting it together. Even Dustin, who has been known to be a little acerbic in his day. Sometimes I love being Irish. This is one of those times. Thanks a million at Saw Doctors and at Tolu McKay." And it does take, it takes the two of you to really need to give us that, that sense of it. But it struck me, Leo, when Tolu was describing her emotions there, and I felt this listening to it for the first time. I thought, wow, this is today's, and so, as in, I can't get on the N17 today to travel to see my mother, my father, my grandmother, my aunts, my uncles, whatever it is. That there was a kind of a way that the lyrics transferred into the current COVID situation that was uncanny. Did that strike you, Leo?
It didn't, actually, now that you mention it, and now that you say it, it's very obvious. But it is amazing how songs find their times, and some songs find different times for themselves. And I know what you're saying there makes an awful lot of sense to me there, that people can't get moving on the road, and it, there's that longing just to be able to hug your loved ones. And that's a very interesting observation, definitely.
Was it there for you, Tolu? Because I think that's what you were touching on, wasn't it? You know, and as with back in 30 years ago, the N17, for N17, take N52, N1, N2, M4, whatever road it is you travel home.
Like, the thing is, like, it wouldn't be true. Like, I wouldn't have been able to express it if I was relating it, like, to how it was 30 years ago, if I'm being honest, because, you know, that's not my experience, you know? So I really had to, like, really find my own self in it to be able to, like, kind of clearly sing it. Because I believe, like, if you're going to, you know, perform something, it needs to come from a authentic or true place so that other people can relate to it easily or find themselves in what you're singing.
Yeah.
The lyrics, like, if a lyric is able to have a duality or even last across decades, it's incredible. There's no doubt about that. So yeah, thank you.
Well, take a bow, Leo Rosen, on that one for sure.
Yes.
Leo Moran, rather, on that one. For you, you were the man that gave those lyrics. And take a bow, Tolu McKay, for the version that you give us. I think we should go back and listen to a little bit more of the new version of the song. But so great to speak to both of you this evening and to bring you together on the airwaves. So final words, Leo, to Tolu, if you want.
Oh, just a huge thank you. And there is no doubt about it. You certainly put your heart into it and made it your own, and you've brought it into the third decade of the 21st century, kicking and screaming. Fair play to you. Thanks a million.
Thank you so much. And I'd also love to say thank you to everybody, the Saw Doctors, like, for creating such a sick and such a beautiful song. And for everybody that has messaged me, I really appreciate the love, the care, and the message that you send. Yeah, because some of the messages were so personal and so touching and so moving. Like, I was reduced to tears as well. So yeah. I really do appreciate that.
Leo,
thank you very much.
Thanks a million to both of you for being with us this evening. And let's leave the last words to Tolo via Leo. Yes, what a wonderful re-realization of the Saw Doctor's N17 that is from Tolo McKay in that arrangement with the RTE Concert Orchestra as first heard on New Year's Eve. 18 minutes past seven on Monday night's arena. Anthony Gormley is a British sculptor, best known for his striking installation of human figures outdoors, be they on beaches, in the sea, on the top of city buildings, or, as in the case of his most iconic work, Angel of the North, on a hilltop outside Gateshead. His art has always connected with the entire tradition of sculpture, going back in time, looking east and west, and I'm sure he'd want me to add north and south, so it's fitting that he now explores that tradition in a new book, Shaping the World, Sculptor from Prehistory to Now, and it's a book written in collaboration with art critic Martin Grayford. Delighted to have Anthony Gormley join me on the line this evening. In fact, it's the form of a conversation, really, between yourself and Martin Grayford. Anthony, when did the conversation start?
Well, it's lovely to talk to you, Sean. It started about 20 years ago. I had a show at Santiago de Compostela, and Martin was sent over by his paper, and that's when we first met. And I have to say that we didn't see so much of each other. I mean, I read this incredible Life of Michelangelo that he wrote, wrote to him saying how much I admired it. And then he suggested that, as he'd done these couple of books with David Hockney about looking at pictures, that he would like to do one about looking at things, and suggested that we might do it together. And so he started coming to my studio, and over 2 years, we had these chats, and we'd send each other, you know, pictures of things that we thought were interesting to talk about. So he did all the legwork, and I just sat and chatted. But it's turned out really, beautifully, I think. And I have to, I just take my hat off to him. Yeah. It was a very, very enjoyable process.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the fact that Martin had done the book of around paintings with David Hockney. Because there was no doubt in your mind you weren't going to be talking about paintings. Sculpture is the king of the arts. That is more or less what you say from the very outset here. What do you think gives it such primacy?
Well, I think it's the difference between a thing in the world and a picture. A picture, it depends on a surface. That surface depends on a wall. A wall depends on a roof. I mean, there's a sense. I mean, yes, we all know that there are, paintings in caves. There are paintings on rock shelters in Australia that have survived for thousands of years. But on the whole, paintings are, they are dependent on context and on protection. And sculpture doesn't have that dependency. It is something that can, as you've just said about my work, be anywhere.
Yeah.
And that's the exciting thing, is because you put this still silent object in the stream of life, and suddenly it starts doing something. It's active. It's a foreign object in a world that is, on the whole, functional or elemental. And immediately there's a conversation that goes on, and I think that's what gives it its excitement. It's a proposition. It's a materialized proposition that in some way confronts the world, and that's a very different thing to making a picture.
Yeah, it's not, there's more involved here than to paraphrase Orwell. It's not just a case of three dimensions good, two dimensions bad. There's more involved than that.
Yeah, I think you know, for me, well, it was interesting because I thought we were, you know, because he's a Renaissance scholar, I thought we might get stuck in the Renaissance, but. He was happy to come out of his comfort zone and go, in a way, to places that might not traditionally have been thought of sculpture at all. So, you know, the caves of Ellora and Ajanta, or the stones of Stenness, you know, in the Orkneys. The idea that actually this notion of maybe not making figurative or copies of bodies identify sculpture, but the sculpture is about placemaking. It's about marking territory. It's about taking a stone that was lying, a naturally formed stone that was lying, and standing it up, and thereby making a place in space at large, and at the same time marking a time. Marking a kind of moment in a you could say geological narrative where human beings begin to want to intervene in time that is beyond mortal time.
On that particular topic, in the idea of taking a stone and putting it, moving it to its position, whatever, in the landscape, and making an intervention in that respect, did you actually visit Uisneach in County Westmeath? Did you spend time there?
Of course I did.
Yeah, and what struck you about it? What struck you?
Well, what's amazing about the cat stone on Uisneach Hill is that it's a naturally formed, glacial erratic. But it has this extraordinary presence. And, of course, the hill that it's on has this extraordinary, you know, ability to look at whatever, you know, 13 counties of Ireland. And the you could say that this is a kind of natural thing that then human beings have tried to copy, you know, like Mount Fuji. You know, Mount Fuji is a naturally made thing, but it's a marker in space that people have recognized has a kind of iconic form. And it's interesting to me that actually, you know, that notion of a mountain has found its material equivalent in humanly made, you know, whether it's Silbury Hill or these great stupas, you know, the at Sanchi or in Kandy, or, you know, all over the Southeast Asia.
In fact, there's one of the early pictures. I must say, too, the illustrations in the book are quite extraordinary. Some of the photographs that we get are amazing. You know, you could flick
well,
through.
Well, we spent as long. I think. Well, it wasn't me. It was Rosalind Horne, who's my wonderful kind of assistant at the studio, who deals with publication. She spent about 6 months chasing. You know, we have this wonderful picture of. Yeah, people cleaning the great Buddha in Nara in Japan. And, you know, if it hadn't been for her absolute insistence that she wasn't going to use conventional images of Karnak or of Stonehenge, but she was going to find really, really sparkling, like, new views of old known things. And that makes a big difference.
Yeah, one of the ones that really struck me, and it's quite early in the book, if I remember correctly, is Parin Arvana, the Parin Arvana, if I'm saying that word correctly, the Buddha in Sri Lanka.
Yeah, Polonnaruwa. Polonnaruwa, which I visited. I was a good hippie and went east for about 3 years. And that was another of those encounters for me, rather like the encounter, you know, with the head of Amenhotep II in the British Museum, that just stopped me in my tracks and made me feel this is the thing. You know, being able to take a bit of a mountain and turn it into this sublime image of, in a way, the relationship between consciousness and matter, which is what the sleeping Buddha of Polonnaruwa is. I mean, it's just amazing. It's maybe 18 meters long. The head alone is the size of a man, lying on its side. But what's incredible about it is the way that, you know, the stucco surface that must have been original to it has all worn off in time, and the stratification of the rock, you know, below that surface has now become, you know, in a way, a kind of geological evocation of the way that the mind flows through matter. And that was a moment for me. It's literally a mountain that has been formed by human hands.
And I mean, as you say, looking at the picture is quite an exhilarating experience. I can only imagine what standing in front of the actual figure must be. You go so far to say, Anthony Gormley, that in fact sculpture, if I'm not misquoting you or putting words into your mouth here, was kind of the first form of language, or certainly an initial, perhaps, mode of communication within communities.
Yeah, I would say that you know, that the touching, the reassurance that we have about the world comes through touch. And, you know, in the book there is this 1.7, 1.5, 1.7 million year old, little 3-inch in diameter, almost perfect spherical object that is called a bolus. And it was found in Olduvai, the place where our kind of proto-hominid ancestor, Australopithecus afarensis, was found by Leakey a long time ago. And the idea, we know that language was not possible. We didn't have the palate. We didn't have the shape of the mouth or the action of the tongue that was able to make words. However, it's very clear that this is a humanly made object that looks uncannily, because it's made out of this calcium carbonate that sort of sparkles, it looks uncannily like the moon. And the idea that, you know, our ancient ancestors made this thing and then passed it from hand to hand. So for me, it's a really powerful idea of a form of communication that is material.
Yeah, a sublime
and
version of
language.
Yeah, a sublime version of Pass the Parcel in some ways. A very, very different. I wonder, was it a very different?
Well, except that the parcel is unwrapped from the very beginning, and the unwrapping has to happen in the mind of the holder. The association of this thing that has a certain weight and density with perhaps the largest, found object in deep space, the moon. Might or might not occur to you, but it certainly occurred to me on seeing this object.
How different do you think, because you do draw a quite a strong distinction here between statuary and sculpture. How important is that difference, or what are we talking about when we start recognising that difference?
Well, I think that at a certain stage in kind of certainly in European culture, the statue took over from a wider idea of material culture shaping the world, and became in a way the commonplace for gosh, which is a very small part of the total, and it sort of took on the duty of representing and supporting power. So statues of either mythological gods or powerful politicians or kings or naked women, sexy women, became in a way the equivalent of sculpture. And I think it lost, as it were, the magic of its placemaking and in a way confrontational potential. And I use my own body as a found object. I'm not pretending that it has intrinsic beauty, but I try to make, as it were, these industrial fossils that you could say act like standing stones. They are markers in space and time, but they are there in a way to reorientate us to notions of scale, to the relationship between skin and horizon, for example. I guess, you know, there's a bit of a paradox about me kind of saying, even though I make works that carry, as it were, the index of the body, that I should be so questioning of the limitations of statue, but I think of the statue. But I think my work works very, very differently. It's very important, for instance, when it's on the ground, that it shares the ground with the viewer. It isn't on a plinth. It isn't an idealized thing. It's very important that it's often multiple. In other words, it betrays the fact that it comes from a time of mechanical reproduction. And what? I think thereby it acts on us differently to, as it were, the unique, isolated plinthed object of a statue.
And I suppose in the case of plinthed objects, we're certainly talking about that in the case of the slave trader Edward Colson and the statue that was toppled into the harbour in Bristol, or indeed the protests around Cecil Rhodes, the statue at Oxford University. Where do you stand on the toppling or the dismantling of those statues? Indeed, we had our own controversy here.
Well, my feeling is that we can't escape our own history by hiding evidence of it. I would not remove Rhodes. I did suggest that they just left him on his plinth, but turned him to face the wall. I think that, you know, the Robert E. Lee monuments have become magnets for white supremacy in the southern states of North America are another case in point. I would not, as it were, remove them. I think that we are all victims, whether we were perpetrators or slaves, of that history. And I think that we need to be very, very careful about how we learn from history. And we certainly don't learn from it by amnesifying ourselves from its memory.
Lovely to speak with you this evening, Anthony, and every best wish to you and yours for 2021.
Lovely to talk to you, Sean, too. Take care.
All
bye
the best.
For now.
That's Anthony Gormley, and he was speaking to us about his book, Shaping the World, Sculpture from Prehistory to Now, by Anthony Gormley and Martin Gifford. It's published by Thames and Hudson. 25 minutes to 8 on Monday night's arena, and I'm just see that the category winners of this year's Costa Book Awards have been announced. Delighted to see that Yvonne Boland posthumously won the Costa Poetry Award, and that's for her final collection, The Historians, which Paula Meehan reviewed for us here on the programme, in fact, on November the 2nd. So Yvonne Boland won the Costa Poetry Award for her posthumous collection, final collection, The Historians. Michael Sheen and David Tennant are back in a new series of Staged, which was a huge hit of the first lockdown of 2020. It sees the pair attempt to navigate their, quote, new normal at home with their increasingly exasperated families while simultaneously trying to tackle the world of virtual Hollywood and their ever more fragile egos. And to be delighted to be joined again by the creator and writer of Staged, Simon Evans. Simon, we spoke at the time of the first series, and I don't think I had seen all of it and had all of the delights of the various guest stars who appeared throughout that series. We can probably talk about some of them. I know you'll barely tell me what happens in episode one of season two. But just for those who didn't see stage one, give us the basic premise that set you off on making this first lockdown series with Michael Sheen and David Tennant.
Sure, and look, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back and talking to you again. What a bizarre and quick-moving year. So series one was based on the idea that David Tennant and Michael Sheen were supposed to be doing a play in the West End, and I was supposed to be their director. I had wrangled these two megastars to be in my play, and then the pandemic hit, and my character being too ambitious, I suppose, if not particularly effectual, decided that he would try and keep them both on board, David and Michael, by rehearsing the play via Zoom. Yeah. But it actually sort of degrades pretty quickly into just them filling time on Zoom. It should feel, I hope it feels like, you've accidentally clicked on the wrong link in a Zoom meeting and found yourself on a Zoom call with David Tennant and Michael Sheen. Yeah. They don't know you're there, and you just sit quietly and listen to them talk about absolute rubbish for 15 minutes.
I'm wondering how they would feel about you using the term degrade. That's degrade into something, because it was a very entertaining 15 minutes. They may have been talking absolute rubbish, but absolute rubbish that to a large extent the words were put into their mouths by you, or was it a very improvised and loose system?
It was very much put into their mouths by me, at least to begin with. I mean, we had so little time to make it. Both seasons, we felt we were fighting against relevance. In both cases, we thought the world is about to return to normal. We hope the world is about to return to normal. People won't want to watch anything that Zoom related or pandemic referencing as soon as they go back to normal. So let's move really quickly. So I wrote scripts, and they were pretty detailed. But then the joy of writing both series really was that I was sort of writing it while we were filming it. So I was writing later episodes while we were filming it. So I was just spending a lot of time with David and Michael. And when we weren't filming, they were just chatting and I was scribbling things down. Whenever one or the other of them would say something funny to the other, I would write it down. And all I then had to do was pretty much copy verbatim what they've said. And then when they both stopped one or the other of them because they were too polite, I just pushed them another stage or two. I just said, what if you carried on for another couple of minutes? What madness would you start talking about? And that was just a treat.
And we had the treat of Samuel Jackson. We had the treat of Judi Dench. We had the treat of so many great stars who appeared, and the families of both David Tennant and Michael Sheen, who I don't know whether they kind of found themselves in the first series by default or not, but they were there as well. So where are we as season two starts? What's the state of play with these two versions of Michael Sheen and David Tennant, rather fragile egos that these particular two actor stroke characters have?
Well, what can I tell you? Well, we do take it in a slightly different... We were so thrilled and delighted by how well it had been received. And because of that, there was certainly, it felt like an appetite from the BBC and from people who'd watched it for more. But we all had a bit of a concern that when this is a thing of its time and of its place, and it's Zoom based, and the second series is still that. So we thought there has to be some slightly new way of approaching it. So there is something, it's a little bit different, but I won't spoil that yet.
Right.
But fundamentally, I think the first series was set in a time when everybody, well, at least in the UK, everyone's experience was the same. We were all in the same version of lockdown. So everyone was going through the same rules, the same restrictions. Everyone was unique in how, you know, what their family unit was and how it was affecting them. But the rules were the same. Whereas we started to create this in a time when everyone was sort of returning to normality at slightly different rates. And, you know, I had friends who were going back to work immediately, whereas theatre and film was sort of stalling behind. So this series is a bit more about, there are parts of the world that are getting back to normal. And will David and Michael be pulled along with that, or will they be left behind by that? So it's a bit more about this next phase, I think, of, can we just get back to normal now? I'm missing it.
And I suppose in the case of an actor, the one thing that gets life back to normal is the wondrous delight of a call from your agent. However, you might hope that your agent would have a rough idea who you were. Let's listen to a clip. Michael Sheen, his American agent, played by Ben Schwartz, is on here. And I think he must represent David Tennant as well. I know so little about it, they wouldn't even let me look at episode one. So let's listen to a clip.
Sure.
David, you still have the same Gmail account? Great. And Michael, I don't have any contact information. May I send it to your band's MySpace account?
You have no contact. You're my agent and you have no contact information for me.
Is this you? The real David Frost at AOL.com?
That is not me.
Okay, I have been emailing that person. You've been getting a bunch of branded stuff. I'm going to scroll through it. Tenet, did you get the Tenet audition?
The Tenet audition?
Yeah, no, Tenet. Tenet, Christopher Nolan did a movie called Tenet. The Joker, did you get that?
No,
you got a straight offer for Joker? Did you get that?
No, I didn't get any of them.
A lot of his stuff goes to Martin Sheen. That's usually who people really want.
Okay, all right. So I'll forward your stuff to Martin Sheen. Does that sound good?
No, that works. Just do that, Tom.
There you go. That's Tom is the name of the American agent there, I'm guessing, played by Ben Schwartz, and Michael Sheen, played by Michael Sheen, David Tennant, played by David Tennant, and Simon Evans, creator and co-creator and writer and director, is on the phone with me this evening ahead of season two of Stage, which starts tonight, I believe, isn't it, on BBC, Simon?
Yeah, that's right. It starts in 2 hours, as long as Boris Johnson's announcement doesn't overrun that we're all looking forward to.
Forward to it a lot. You appeared in the last season yourself now. Did you put yourself into a more of a creator and director role this time, or is there still a little bit of acting going on?
No, I still pop up as well. I think you need to have somebody in there that David and Michael can just beat down upon whenever the occasion arises. I think it was lovely when you bring in people like Sam and Judy and some of the amazing people that we've got second series. They usually come in order to deflate Michael and David a little bit. Right. So it's always good to have a punching bag, and I seem to have fallen neatly into that role. So it's always helpful to put me in it just to let them bend.
Yeah, I noticed it's Sam and Judy now. I would have thought it was Mr. Jackson and Dame Judy when you were doing season one. A lot easier to get people to make those little cameo appearances, I would guess, for season two.
Yes, it very much is. And they're Lord Jackson and Dame Judy, of course, to their faces. The world is still, in some ways it was easier because people had seen the first series and seemed to have enjoyed it. And we found that we were going out to people and we had a sort of proof of concept, which had been reasonably well received. So everyone felt a bit safer jumping into our sandbox to play. But then on the other hand, when we made the first series, Samuel L. Jackson and Judy Dench were both sitting at home with nothing else to do. So us knocking on their door saying, do you want to come and play, was perhaps an easy thing. Whereas when we went out to people for the second series, some of them were starting to Right. go through that return to normality and were starting to work. So there was a bit more of a juggling of schedule. Right. So yes, there was a great warmth for the show, which is lovely. But similarly, people were, back at it. And so we had to negotiate that.
Waste of my time asking you who's appearing in season two, apart from Michael Sheen and David Tennant, I know, so I won't. Simon, lovely to speak with you again.
So lovely to speak to you. Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Not at all. Simon Evans there, and that second season of Staged Tarts on BBC One Television tonight at 9:45. It's the new year, as I'm sure we've all noticed by now. So how do you feel about a bit of dystopia based around a pandemic? Yeah, I feel a bit that way myself. But the makers of The Stand beg to differ. It's a new series. Let's have a listen to a section from the opening of the first episode of the first series.
Bitter days ahead. Death and terror. Betrayal and tears. And not all of you will live through them. Dark man grows stronger all the time. I know you feel it too. Soon he'll come to destroy all who stand against him. His kingdom's in the West, and it is there. You must go and make your stand. This is what God wants of you.
Go and make your stand. This is what God wants of you. A clip from the new TV adaptation of Stephen King's post-apocalyptic novel, The Stand. Back in 1978, King's novel described a band of survivors trying to find their way in a world that had been turned upside down and inside out by a pandemic. I joke you not. Chris Wasser has been watching this new miniseries from CBS and Starzplay, and he joins me now. You couldn't make up the timing on this. I know all of last year, Chris, I found myself saying in studio, isn't that amazing that you wrote that piece before lockdown, before there was any talk of pandemic, and look how that song or that film or that play that we're talking about fits in with our current situation. But this is uncanny how it fits in, given that it was written back in 1978.
It really is. Something else. I mean, King, you could not move on Twitter last year, especially around the start of the pandemic, without somebody comparing what was going on in real life to a Stephen King story, specifically The Stand. And back in March 2020, which seems about, 18 years ago at this stage, when the World Health Organization declared a pandemic, Stephen King actually took to Twitter and said, he responded to these accusations that how did you know what was going to happen almost, but he said, no, listen, coronavirus is not The Stand, it's not anywhere near as serious, it's eminently survivable, keep calm and take all reasonable precautions. Now that was 10 months ago, that was right on the cusp, that was just before things got bonkers, Sean. So it is uncanny and it is quite unusual, but I'm sure the folks at CBS and Starzplay were only too happy to have actually wrapped the series of The Stand, because this thing has been so long in the making, right before production on TV and films, TV shows and films in Vancouver were shut down all over the place, because this thing has taken so long to get off the ground. We've heard at one stage that Ben Affleck was involved, John Borman was tipped to direct this thing some 15, 20 years ago. I think the problem in getting this thing to the screen again, because it was a miniseries back in the the early 90s, was that the novel could stop a bullet, John. It's 1,152 pages long. So it's been so big, it features so many characters, that it's just had a long and tumultuous journey back into the screen again. But finally, we have a new one this week.
And the basic setup is there is a pandemic, but I guess and I'm giving nothing away by saying this, that the pandemic was in fact released from a scientific place in the middle of the States, and the government knew all about it, and as a result they sent it off to Russia, they sent it off to China, so that it was a worldwide thing rather than just one country, i.e. America, affected by it.
No, that's it in one. Yeah, it's a man-made virus, and it's such a fantastic opener as well. And again, we're not giving anything away. This is just a setup, but it's a virus that begins in the U.S. Department of Defense lab. It's the government has developed this lethal strain of influenza, highly contagious. They've developed it as a biological weapon. But unfortunately, as is always the case in these fictional disaster scenarios, there's always a security breach. And unfortunately, a guy by the name of Campion, Charles Campion, he's a security guard. He panics when this disease is accidentally released, and he grabs his family on the army base where he lives, and he literally drives as far away from this thing as possible. He actually travels 2,000 miles across America, spreading this virus over 2 days, and then within a month, the world has essentially come to an end. There's also an interesting subplot about, how America actually releases the virus into Russia and China so that they're not the only nation that will fall. But as is always the case with Stephen King novels, there's your big plot, there's your big story, but we're focusing on the ordinary men, the ordinary men and women on the ground. And we're kind of following Stuart Redman, and he's the first character we meet in both the novel and, this new series, who is immune to the virus. So essentially, it's all about the survivors. It's all about these men and women who are seeing these visions at night when they're sleeping, and they're the only ones in the world that, where humanity is almost extinct, who are immune to the virus. We don't know why, and that's the thing that we're trying to figure out. Why have these people been left behind?
Well, one thing, or two things that they have in common, are two dreams that they've all had, these dreams. What have the dreams been about?
It's so strange because that sounds like a really ordinary, uncanny setup about this pandemic. But we do trip over into, full on fantasy mode, because when Stephen King was starting to write The Stand, he wanted to write about, an America that was decimated by a plague, and that would feature characters like the hobbits and like Gandalf from Lord of the Rings, because he made no secret that, five novels into his career, he was known as the Master of Horror. He wanted to be a fantasy writer. That was the original goal. So he decided to incorporate this fantasy element where all of the survivors have two different dreams, and it's up to them then which dream they want to follow. One of the dreams features a 108-year-old prophet, a Christian prophet, who is calling on them to come out to Boulder, California, and to start a new life there. Another one features a very mysterious, terrifying figure who they know as the Dark Man, but his name is Randall Flagg, and let's just say he's almost the devil incarnate. And you've got, the ghost folks following Mother Abigail, and you've got the killers and the criminals following Randall Flagg to Las Vegas, which, Stephen King back in the 1970s said that's the Mordor of the piece. So it's an age old battle of good versus evil, which just so happens to have a story that we can all relate to in the center of it.
Mother Abigail, the character that you mentioned there, played by none other than Whoopi Goldberg.
Hello, Franny. My name is Abigail Fremantle. You come see me at Hemingford Home, Colorado. Can you remember that for me?
There you go, Whoopi Goldberg. And this is the kind of thing that appears, or she does, she appears in the dream to lots of the characters, and they have to choose, are they going to go with the Dark Man, or are they going to go with the good woman, basically is what we're talking about, Chris.
Absolutely, yes. So it's, you've got some of our main characters are rock stars, troubled rock stars. We've got Larry Underwood, we've got Stuart Redman, played by James Marsden, who is this very, very agreeable, affable, everyman lead who also happens to be a widower, who also happened to have experienced a tragedy before the pandemic hit. You've got mysterious characters whose past we'll only find about through flashbacks, both in the novel and in the series. It just goes on and on and on. I mean, even in the first first in the 1994 miniseries, which won a ton of Emmys at the time, you had 125 actors with speaking parts. And this is the challenge then, to take a novel which features so many characters, which tries to do so many things at once, and to make space for it then in a 10-hour series. So that's where I think this series then runs into some complications, because you've got a very talented cast. You've got Greg Kinnear in there, Odessa Young, Alexander Skarsgård, and there's an awful lot of goodwill behind here. You know, you can see that it's so well intentioned, that you know, Josh Boone, the guy who's been trying to develop this for an awful long time, who recently made an X-Men film, The New Mutants, he's trying very hard to make this work. But unfortunately, Sean, there's a little bit too much going on.
Yeah, I only have to put the hands up and say I saw, I think, 95% of episode one. I didn't get the last maybe 5 minutes of it. But even within the first episode, where you kind of need to be carried along and you need to have a little bit of exposition, there was a lot of jumping around in time. And I thought, hold on a minute. Are we in real time now? Are we in the present moment? Are we in the past? Are we in the future? I don't know where. I find myself a little bit confused. Did that, you've watched more of it, obviously, than me. Does that become a little bit easier as the series goes on?
It does not. No, unfortunately, it doesn't. I mean, look, I know this book like the back of my hand. This is hands down my favorite Stephen King novel. And there were times during the first hour, I've watched about 2.5 hours of this thing. There were times during the first hour when I hadn't a clue what was going on. Mm. It's a very structurally disobedient piece, and it's uncertain what Josh Boone is trying to do, but it kept reminding me of Lost. So you remember in Lost, the plane crashes, everyone survives, and then we get to spend, you know, the first and even the second season going through 30 or 40 different characters and, you know, seeing what their lives were like before the plane crashed. That's what this is trying to do in just 8 hours of television. And when you do that with just 8 hours of television, as opposed to whatever it was, it lost 60 or 80 hours, you have to rush. And there's no room, you know, there's no chance for momentum to build. There's no suspense, because we're seeing what characters are like 5 weeks after the virus and then 5 weeks before. You know, you're not really worrying about the fate of any characters, because they all seem to, you know, be alive in the present. And there's this feeling that I got throughout it, which is unusual, because the first 400 pages of the novel, Sean, are all about just the pandemic, all about what happens at first. It's almost as though Josh Boone, or maybe the network, they're in an awful rush to just forget about that.
Yeah.
The plane crash of the piece is in Lost was sensational. In the Stand, the big accident, whatever happened, let's just forget about that. No one need. Maybe there was a feeling with the studio, look, people don't want to see that bit, but you kind of do. You can't just rush to the end of the story without giving us, you know, the beginning and the middle. So it has this non-linear storytelling style that really doesn't suit it. Now, one thing I will say is, though, that there are clearly things put in, because they've transported the action, which, you know, when the novel was first published, it was set in the 80s. Stephen King then edited it to take place in the 90s. Now we're in present day. The present day setting does allow for, you know, neat little, you know, comments, commentary in the background to kind of sneak in that we can all relate to. I mean, at one stage you hear news broadcasters saying, oh, it's going to take an awful lot more than the flu to keep us from celebrating our July 4th.
Yeah.
These are things that we actually heard on the news in real life last year. So that's quite interesting. But I don't know what else having it in a present setting really does for us. So it is a bit all over the place, unfortunately, and even confusing for those who have read it and loved it like myself.
I love the term structurally disobedient. A bit all over the place, I think, is the other way of saying that, isn't it? The other thing that I wanted to ask you about, Chris, was I know it's a dangerous thing when you see a writer in any, you know, in a book, if there's a writer, or in a television play, a screenplay, if there's a writer, to think, oh, how much of Stephen King is in that particular character? But there is a young writer in this particular, certainly he's fairly prevalent in the first episode of the series. How important a character is he, and am I way off the mark to be reading any bit of Stephen King into him?
No, not at all. No, and I'm glad you mentioned him, because there is a lot of Stephen King in there. Harold Lauder, played this time by Owen Teague, who's probably the most valuable player in this series. I was quite impressed with him, because in this series, let's face it, a lot of the characters in here, there's been an awful lot of kickback against the casting in this series. Some white characters are now black, some Hispanic characters are now white. It's quite strange. But my problem is that just a lot of the characters don't look, sound, or behave like anything we knew on the page. But with someone like Owen Teague playing Harold, he's captured that, you know, weird, awkward, you know, young adult aspiring writer who keeps getting, you know, rejection letters from publishers, and he's a little bit weird and he's still trying to find his voice. And yeah, Stephen King was certainly putting his younger self in there, where he was like, you know, this loner character who just wanted to get published and that was it. He is a very important character in this series, because he is all alone, his family have died, and he just thinks that this pandemic will give him a new start in life. So he is quite watchable. He's played very well. I would actually say between himself and James Marsden as Stuart Redmond, you know, the everyday, the everyman character of the piece, as I said, and really the protagonist and the hero towards the end, those two are making it. Those two are the reason that I will come back to this series, because there's not an awful lot else there that's keeping me intrigued.
Well, what about the relationship? Isn't the relationship that the young writer has a bit of a notion on the Amber Heard character, who was a friend of his older sister, and she kind of babysat him for a period of time. So there's a bit of a crush that has to be worked out there. Does that go anywhere?
It does, yeah. So Harold, long story short, Sean, Harold has a crush on this Franny Goldsmith played by Odessa Young, and the two of them end up traveling cross-country. That will go to some very interesting places, and unfortunately Harold's character goes to some very interesting places. So, as I said, it's Harold's character development that will probably keep me watching, and I wouldn't be surprised if in another 6 or 7 weeks I say, look, he was pretty great. The rest of the series, not so much.
All right, so that's it, Chris Wasser. So make of that what you may. If you're in lockdown, you might be prepared to give it a bit of time and see if it goes far enough for you. The Stand, it will be available to watch on Starzplay, a streaming app via the Apple Store. And it's available from now, I do believe. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields, research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jimmy Doyle was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme, produced by Kay Sheehy. Great to be back. Happy New Year to one and all.